Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hello, this week we're podcasting from another unusual location. Last week it was the cottage, this week it's the basement of our new office.
Yep, there's a lot of boxes in here and some paint and some donuts that have gone off.
Yeah, but we chose it mainly for its excellent selection of loo roll, which we hope might make the quality of this podcast a bit better, if that makes sense. It's an interesting change of space.
Yeah, so I mean it's been quite a hectic week because we were at Latitude last week and then we've moved office straight after that, and we haven't fully got our new podcasting suite set up. Never mind, the show goes on.
Podcasting suite would be a generous phrase to ever describe.
Room with chairs. Room with chairs is what I mean by that.
Oh, no chairs, as we are on the floor right now.
But other big stuff has been happening this week. Nicki Minaj and Taylor Swift have had all kinds of beef. You stayed up quite late talking about this on Twitter, I know.
I have. It's been just, if you love pop stars on Twitter, this has just been an incredible week for pop stars on Twitter, because first of all, Nicki Minaj was just making all these like very, very smart, critically aware tweets about why she may not have got a nomination for Best Video at the MTV Music Awards for Anaconda, even though it was everywhere. And then Taylor Swift decided that one of Nicki's tweets was a dig at her, took it very personally, because Nicki had said, you know, if you've got like the stereotypically like horned over white skinny body, then your video will get a nomination. And Taylor was like, hey, all I've ever done is love and support you, which was very uncomfortable for everyone because it was like, Taylor, you really missed the point here. And then Katy Perry got involved.
As ever, yeah.
Best day of Katy Perry's life, I'm sure. And Ed Sheeran got involved. It was just massive, but it basically ended with Taylor Swift apologising, which I think was quite a good outcome, really.
And quite a nice apology as well. She was basically saying, I misspoke. She wasn't one of those like non-apology apologies where she said, I'm sorry if you're offended. She said,
I'm sorry that my video was so good.
Yeah, she actually said, like, I misspoke, I misunderstood, and I'm sorry, which I thought was good.
I mean, we can't really know to what extent it was actually sincere, but I'm pretty pleased. Yeah. And Nicki Minaj was like, you know what, I've always really liked Taylor Swift, so this is fine, we're all cool. So it's gone pretty well, I think.
Yeah, and nice to see a celebrity feud end in such a way that it cannot forever be cited by the Daily Mail as like a catfight or something.
Yeah, exactly. They can't like trivialise the issue at hand, which was actually very important, by just being like, oh, catfight. Mm. So yeah, that was big stuff this week. But what we're going to talk about now is My Mad Fat Diary, which is a Channel 4 drama that's had 3 seasons and made waves. We're here with Barbara Speed, who's a Mad Fat Diary fan.
Yes, yeah. Not a mad fan, but a good fan. I started watching the first series when I was in my first year of university, so it's been kind of going for 3 years with 3 kind of different series. And it's an interesting one because, so when it finished kind of earlier this month, there were a lot of think pieces about it, which you might not really expect because it's a teen program, it's aimed at teenagers, but there were kind of fully grown people saying how they kind of wish this had existed kind of when they were younger. I guess it's a bit like stuff like Rookie, that is treating young concerns in a more serious way. which people really responded to, I guess.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that was interesting about it as well is it seems to have done fairly well sort of by word of mouth in the States. Because it does feel to me like a very British programme. I don't know if you want to summarise basically what it's about.
Yeah, so it's based on the diaries of Ray Earle, who's a British writer and broadcaster, and she it's actually about her, it is her diary, so it's really set in the late 80s. But for the programme, they kind of transposed it to the late 90s.
My name is Ray. It's 1996. I'm 16, 16 stone and desperate for a shag. Oh yeah, and I've been in a mental hospital for a while. But I'm going to listen to the Love Doctor and take on the big wide world.
Mum!
Of course, that means leaving the madhouse behind me. Today is the first day of the rest of my life. I'm going to find out if there really are any cool people in Lincolnshire.
She's a big like music fan, so they've kind of made her an 80s music fan living in the 90s, so they can kind of keep some of her the stuff that she likes.
Is it set in the 90s?
Yeah, it's set in the late 90s.
That absolutely passed me by, because it just feels
like
those
timeless,
kinds of...
Yeah. Isn't it?
The eternal not now, isn't it? It's just, it's definitely not now, but it could really be anything from, I'd say, like 1975 to 2005.
Because yeah. She's got all these like Oasis, Blur, Britpop posters and like Damon Albarn's on the back of her mirror. So I was quite like, oh, maybe she's just like, because the 90s are big now. So yeah. Maybe she's just like,
yeah. You know, she's doing all that for the first time.
But it's a bit like, I mean, Caroline, you made the comparison to me of Made by Wolves, the Catlin Moran
Raised program. By Wolves.
Raised yeah, by Wolves, sorry. Yeah. And it's similar to that in that maybe when it's somebody's memories from a quite different era and then they put it into a yet another era, it does become a bit kind of ageless.
It actually really reminded me of that, which is another sort of Channel 4 series. It's more explicitly a comedy, but it, especially in terms of its like place, I really, really love like British TV shows that are set in these sort of towns that could basically be anywhere
well,
in
this
the UK.
This is Lincolnshire, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and even though we're a long way from Lincolnshire, it really like speaks to my like growing up. Mm. Even though I'm from the south, as you can probably tell from my accent, compared
and it's
to
very British. Like a key location is the chip shop where they just always go all the time,
and the pub,
and the pub where the pub that serves underage people.
Yeah, which is a real classic. Everyone went to the pub that just like turned a blind eye at the 16-year-olds, and that all of that stuff felt very, very timeless.
But yeah, so it is interesting that it found an American audience in that context. But I think that maybe, I mean, Rael herself, when the series finished, wrote a piece about why it's still so relevant now, even though her diaries are obviously kind of before young people today were born. Mm-hmm. But she just says that with any kind of teen story, the themes are kind of so universal and everyone's been there. Like maybe they had different insecurities in their small town in Georgia, America, but they would be able to identify with it. And it has a huge internet following as well. It's obviously hard to know exactly where that's located, but obviously young people from lots of different places really responded to it.
And I'm guessing part, or probably the majority of what they respond to, is its treatment of mental health issues.
Yeah, so I mean, quite clearly, I think a lot of the people just directly identify with the main character. So just to give some background, the series opens with her leaving a mental health facility where she's been for the past 4 months, and then she goes back to school and doesn't tell anyone where she's been, and so
she's been in France.
Yeah, exactly. It's a euphemism. But she's kind of navigating all that normal teenage stuff, but with this slightly darker backstory. And I think that a lot of people either who've been through something similar or kind of identify with some of that stuff, because she's also like a bigger character as well, which hence Mad Fat Diary, but again I think a lot of people identify with her because she's actually also very confident, and a big storyline is just that she makes these kind of really great friends and gets this really great boyfriend. And I think it's quite a sort of encouraging program for people who maybe have struggled with similar things.
I've only seen a couple of episodes, but I definitely intend to watch more. But there's a moment in the very first one where she goes to a pool party with these new friends, and there's this horrifying moment, which for anyone who is like more than a size 10 will have had a moment like
this.
Or just anyone. Where, you know, you're wearing a swimming suit in front of people who you're trying to impress, and she decides to try and go down to show that she's fun, to like go down the slide into the pool, and she gets stuck. And the way this is dramatized is brilliant, because like the camera kind of hovers on the back of her head, and there's like kind of everything slows down, and there's like kind of almost like a heartbeat in the back, when you can just feel her thinking and her panic. But the way she comes out of it is that she makes a joke. Like, she says to the one of them, like, oh, you've got big muscles, come and help me pull me out of this slide. And everyone laughs, and basically she signaled to everyone that, like, I'm okay with this, so you can be okay with this too.
And there's another level to that, isn't there, where she's really embarrassed with all the scars on her legs from when she's been self-harming, and her size, and the fact that she doesn't know these people, and she's a bit uncomfortable in her friend's, like, posh house compared to hers. And it's just all these feelings that you remember so vividly going on at once. And it's just so beautifully done. Mm. It's a real crushing moment, and then it just lifts instantly.
Yeah, it's really, really. And you mentioned her music taste. I really love the use of music in the show, both for her characters, because obviously she's decided that, you know, I'm never going to be pretty or popular, but being really into music is something that I can bring to this social group. And then also the way that they blend that into the background music of the show. Like, there was loads of Suede and Blur and like bands I really like and had sort of vaguely forgotten about, but that was really good. But I specifically wanted to talk about her relationship with food as well, because that's particularly in the first episode, this kind of cupboard where her mother keeps all of the sweets and chocolate is like a recurring image in her mind. Whenever anything goes wrong, she immediately starts thinking about, well, I could just eat and then this would all go away.
And there's also, I mean, another thing worth mentioning is the editing is done in such a way that it's always very focused on her mental state, which again is, I think, why it's actually a very good representation of mental illness. So, say with this cupboard, it'll kind of like everything goes dark and the cupboard is glowing. Yeah. I can't remember exactly, but because it's also a diary, there's often kind of sketches,
annotations on the screen. Yeah.
And so you're always very much inside her head, and this kind of obsession with this cupboard and like revulsion at the same time is very.
And she'll walk past it and kind of touch it fairly gently, but there's earlier on in the episode before she reaches a crisis where she's like, okay, I'm gonna like go to the cupboard.
Her relationship with food actually made me think of a bit from Catelyn Moran's How to Be a Woman that I wanted to read, which is about the kind of demeaning of food issues and sort of body dysmorphia below things like drug and alcohol addiction, when actually it comes from exactly the same impulse, which I think is a view that she got quite a lot of sort of flack for when she expressed it, but I think it's perfectly valid. So in the book she writes, in a nutshell, then, by choosing food as your drug, sugar highs or the deep soporific calm of carbs, the Valium of the working classes, you can still make the packed lunches, do the school run, look after the baby, pop in on your mum, and then stay up all night with an ill five-year-old, something that is not an option if you're caning off a giant bag of skunk or regularly climbing into the cupboard under the stairs and knocking back quarts of scotch. Overeating is the addiction choice of carers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of speaks to Ray's character, doesn't it? Because she feels like a total screw-up, but actually she's, for someone with her problems, she's extremely functional.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I think that something I quite like about the programme is it's a lot of it is about being fat and about this kind of stuff, but they make the fatness quite separate from her mental health problems. And there was a piece on the AV Club about kind of size and women in TV, and it kind of says something quite interesting, which is that it's about living with being fat, not trying to get thin. It's not really, there's not really a focus on her thinking, if I'm thin, I'll be okay at all. It's that she needs to overcome the mental health issues. That's the problem. The fatness is kind of either irrelevant or just a symptom of that.
Yeah, and her friend Chloe, who's like much slimmer, is smoking in a changing room, and she's like, what are you doing? And she's like, oh, you know, I've started smoking, it keeps you thin. And she kind of rolls her eyes.
Yeah, and I did like the imagery actually of the bit where she kind of steps out of her fat self. She kind of unzips an imaginary fat suit and throws it in the bin. But again, that's portrayed very much not as a, like, I will be happier if I'm thinner, just as a kind of, like, the weight of my issues.
Yeah, if I am happier, I won't care, basically. Yeah. And that, again, the narrative of, because over the course of three series, she does get much better and she does have all kinds of successes, and those are never to do with her body changing at all. They're just about her own self-acceptance and kind of seeing those things that are great about herself. So, as you're saying, like, the humour stuff, her interests, she's, like, actually very popular with her group of friends. It's really interesting.
I think the language that's used to talk about, like, specifically women's bodies as well is really great in it. Like, she calls her doctor right at the beginning professional, like, waterer of lady gardens or something, and she talks about her body as a condom full of bolognese. Like, she just, one of the things that's so amazing about her character is that you're really drawn to the way she speaks and, like, the way she, like, pierces through things in a really nice way.
Yeah, the whole experience of watching it was so, so lovely. And I do really sympathise with that point of view, that if it had existed when I was roughly that age, I would have been so into it.
Because it's not about kind of easy answers. Like, I think there is an element to which saying, oh, well, you can have a really great personality or a really great sense of humour. I mean, it's not...
Or if you're fat, you should be funny.
Yeah, it's not a kind of utopia, but it's this kind of way in which, like, there is always a way to live. There is always a way to kind of get by and, like, have a good time or whatever. Which I think for if you were, like, 15 and really unhappy, I actually think it would be, like, amazing. A very encouraging watch.
Yes, well, a great recommendation, and I think we highly recommend it to listeners as well. It's all on, what's the Channel 4 catch-up?
4OD.
4OD.
I don't know if it is it in America, we don't know, but it definitely is here.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's really good.
Now we're joined by our colleague Stephen Bush, and we're going to talk about the new movie Ant-Man, which is the latest addition to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Stephen, what did you make of this film?
I thought, you know, it was a good fun romp. I mean, there are some problems with it that I'm sure we will discuss in great length. But I think it was a good kind of fun expansion onto the Marvel Universe and had lots of sort of nice knowing winks to it.
I sort of felt like the whole film was one long knowing wink.
Yeah, I was going to say that was the majority rather than
get
the minority.
Get it? He's tiny. He's really little.
Ooh. We should say, if you haven't seen Ant-Man, that I don't believe you can spoil Ant-Man in the sense that it's all in the title. But if you are intending to see it and care deeply about these things, maybe skip to the next segment of the podcast. So, Ant-Man, he is literally a man who shrinks to the size of an ant, and that is his superpower.
Imagine a soldier the size of an insect. The ultimate secret weapon.
If you give godlike powers to everyone, it's going to be chaos.
So how do we stop him?
I know a guy.
Well, he actually just is a man who has a suit that shrinks.
So he's not even genetically super,
Iron Man or... the Batman, or he's a technology based superhero. He's a where the Scott Lang Ant-Man, played by Paul Rudd, has his power. Yeah, you know, his reason to be in the suit is he is an experienced robber and hacker, and the inventor of the Ant-Man suit, Hank Pym, who is played by that Douglas fella,
Michael Douglas,
gets him to steal some stuff. And he steals some stuff, and, you know, it's kind of a classic tale of redemption and shrinking and growing thing.
That classic of shrinking and growing. I suppose Alice in Wonderland's pretty classic. But the part, so far so Marvel, I got that. The part that really surprised me was that not only does he shrink and grow from ant size to man size, but he also has a kind of affinity with ants, i.e. they will obey him and do his bidding.
Yeah, it's never really fully explained, because there's a lot, at the beginning there's a lot of sort of like ants crawling creepily, and you're like, okay, like maybe this is just like atmospheric, and then it becomes clear that Hank Pym is just like talking to the ants, and Paul Rudd is like, wait a second, I thought this was about a suit, how come you're like literally, how are you telling these ants what to do? And he's just like, he like nods his ear, like
he's got a kind of hearing aid thing.
He sends sonic signals to get the ants to assist him with stuff when he's down to the size of an ant.
What does that mean? It wasn't explained at all. He was just like, yep, I can talk to the ants.
I mean, ultimately he has a suit which allows him to shrink to a subatomic level without nuking city.
At least they make the effort to be like, yes, we just removed the space between atom particles, and you're like, obviously that's bollocks, but I appreciate the gesture. Whereas with the ants thing, they were like, don't ask too many questions, we can speak to ants.
But I think something we should probably ask some questions from, I'm suddenly aware of being the male guest on this week's episode, is the somewhat problematic treatment of women in the film.
Oh, yeah. Anna and I actually went to see this film together, and partway through she leaned over to me to went, you notice how her hair has got less sexy as she's got more approachable?
Yeah, I think it's kind of sexier, but yeah, they like, it's very, very severe, and then they're like, oh, wait, she's nice now, we'll take off the red lipstick and like muffle it up a bit. Like,
yeah, so she has... the main female character, Hank Pym's daughter, Hope, has this very kind of severe, sharp, sort of business lady bob. And then when she becomes kind of more approachable and lets her guard down, then she's got, like, beachy waves and freckles. And it's just, yeah, it's kind of obvious what we're supposed to think there.
Yeah, and I mean, so Maria Norris, who for the Staggers writes pieces on anti-terror for me, had tweeted, and she said, if Hope was called Hal, then it would be about a father, like, training his son to do something.
Of course.
Whereas instead of just like, nope, better get a dude in. But I don't think that she's actually the only woman who has the short drift, because the really troubling side thing is the...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Scott Lang is like an absent dad who still thinks it's okay to turn up unannounced at the home of his ex-wife and her partner.
Stroke his daughter's face.
Stroke his daughter, give them gifts that they don't want them to give. Just, you know, Scott Lang does all of the things that controlling ex-partners do.
Yeah, he is just the classic deadbeat dad in this film.
And the interesting thing is actually, in another way, the script half seems to realise this, because the stepfather is actually in many ways one of the most sympathetic characters in the film. He's trying his best to do his job. There's one point where, despite the fact that he has no powers and is definitely going to be utterly destroyed by the villain, he puts himself in front of his stepdaughter, and he ultimately lets Ant-Man get off in order to do the best by his adopted family.
And doesn't he also, at the point, the sort of climax in the movie when everything's exploding, he runs towards the fire, like he runs into the explosion to see if he can help. Yeah, you're right, he is ultimately the hero.
Yeah, and they do start off sort of introducing him as like, oh, what does he call him? Calls him an arsehat or something. One of the things I think is really interesting about this film is, take the image of the ant, and it's like approach to whether we should be like really industrious or whether we should like prioritize our families and that kind of thing. Basically, this is a very like anti-big industry film. Scott Lang, yeah, as you said earlier, he's like a hacker who like brought down a massive corporation because they were like, you know, cheating the little guy, inverted commas. His problem is that he's not providing for his family well enough. And yeah, I was thinking about ants, and Horace writes that ants make conscious and careful provision for the future. And I think this is a film about like what happens when you don't provide for the future as an industry. So in his personal life, he has to like provide for the future of his daughter, and then this big company that's trying to make the tiny suits is not really thinking about what happens in the future.
And there's also the element to that of, there are a few, one of the knowing references you mentioned is that S.H.I.E.L.D. and the Avengers shouldn't have this technology. Hope him wants to keep it out of their hands because they can't be trusted to look after the future with such temptation, with such, you know, what they could do with this. So he's kind of trying to guard his technology against the future.
This film has like a lot of bad points, we should say, but I think if you do want to take it seriously, which is obviously what we try to do here, I think the interesting tension within it is between the importance of industry versus the importance of social bonds. And I think ants traditionally stand for both those things at once, industry and social bonds. Both Milton and Wordsworth talk about them as like creatures that have just incredibly strong like empathy for each other and like work together in a very like human way.
And you see that actually a lot in the intro, almost, to the heist scene where Paul Rudd as Ant-Man is flying on the back of his favorite ant called Anthony, and Anthony gets hit by a bullet or something and dies, or a raindrop or something. Like he he falls, basically, and he falls to the ground. But Paul Rudd just falls straight onto the back of another ant and everything carries on. And it's sort of like the overall, I don't know what's the word for a collective of ants, but anyway, the overall sense the overall sense of the swarm is bigger than just one individual.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's like when Wordsworth talks about how ants are strong by social league, and then when he talks about London in his like really anti-London poem, he calls it a monstrous anthill of a too busy world. So if you become too interested in, I guess, finance would be the ultimate thing here, and not in what's best for each other, everything collapses and you have to put on a tiny suit and fly in and save it all.
We should say a bit about as well about the visuals of the film, because the kind of I found it hilarious, but the sort of to the death fight scene where Ant-Man, the good guy, is fighting the bad guy who is also in a sort of shrinky growy suit, their big fight, where Ant-Man, the good guy, is fighting the bad guy in also in a shrinky growy suit, takes place in a child's bedroom, and they both have the ability, as well as shrinking themselves, to shrink and grow other objects around them. So you get the kind of repetitively hilarious visual of them fighting on a toy train set, and then one of them grows the train and a massive Thomas the Tank Engine bursts out of the top of the house. I really enjoyed that. There's just nothing not amusing about something that was small being large. I don't know.
Yeah, I also thought it's actually one of the things that they do very cleverly in the fight scene, and it might just be nice because there were a lot of families who'd gone to see it together, is you have this scene of ultimate peril where the monster comes home to your bedroom, which is the bit you're meant to be safe in, which is this kind of classic thing that Terence Dix, the kind of legendary, almost the creator of modern Doctor Who, kind of in its kind of 70s peak. So, yeah, what's really scary is not monsters in space, it's coming home and finding a Yeti on the toilet. And it actually takes this sort of quite primal fear and makes it sort of child-friendly again, because there's this fight, there's the child hiding in the closet, but then you zoom out and it's just a fight on a train set than, you know, people have seen in thousands of houses. So it was both funny and quite clever.
Yeah, and that was one of the moments where we felt like Edgar Wright's influence came in, didn't we, with some of the shots where he was kind of like playing with size, because Edgar Wright kind of got booted out of this film, didn't he? There was like a dispute in the studio. Yeah, those shots where they sort of like really zoom in and zoom out made me think a lot of like those classic Shaun of the Dead style.
And using a lot of sound effects along with the jump cuts. I mean, the one I always think of as being very classically him is in Shaun of the Dead, when Simon Pegg's character is just gearing himself like, right, we're gonna have to like go and fight zombies, and they get in the car and you get like door slam, seatbelt click, window up as like three quick sound effects and three quick jump cuts, and I was like, that's classic Edgar Wright, and there was quite a lot of that.
And also, lest we forget, the Hot Fuzz scene in the model village where you know he is impaled on the spire of a church through his mouth because it's a model church. So obviously that kind of playfulness I think is present, even if like the script was probably not up to Edgar Wright standards.
No one offered anyone a cornetto.
I mean in general, once the kind of Marvel era is over, because obviously they are sort of the boring observation that thousands of people made before Incoming Alert. They are kind of the westerns of the modern era. There's one every couple of months. They're these big events, and they're sort of enjoyable, sort of smart, dumb movies. When the Marvel era is over and the story gets written, I'm fascinated to see what the difference is between this final version and the Wright version were.
We should also say something about the choice of Paul Rudd as Ant-Man, because I mean, I don't really keep up with Marvel movie universe news, so I had no idea that he was starring in a Marvel film. And, you know, because Paul Rudd is the guy who was, like, in Friends and films like The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Ron Burgundy's, like, crass mate in Anchorman.
And then you called him the archetypal beta male on the way to the cinema, which is absolutely what you need for a film where the superhero admits that he's only there because he's expendable.
And because he's got a cool suit.
Yeah.
Like, he's not got a kind of genetic modification that makes him awesome. He is just wearing some other genius's invention. But I thought he acquitted himself really well. And for whoever came up with this, but fair play to the person who thought that, well, rather than trying to make him seem Captain America-esque heroic, we're going to use the fact that he's a comic actor to do things like disrupt the cloying, tender moment between the father and his daughter. And we're going to do that kind of, like, awkward comedy. And yeah, I think that was a nice tonal addition.
I think that was the interesting thing, because it didn't... My fear when they dumped Edgar Wright was that it was going to feel like a very generic Marvel movie. And it had all of the hallmarks of being a Marvel movie, while falling exactly as you say, feeling sort of slightly different and handling in a slightly different way. I think the odd thing is, in terms of, sort of good casting, I felt that it was a much better treatment of one of the more off-piste heroes. And I don't know if either of you seen the Amazing Spider-Man films with Andrew Garfield, where Andrew Garfield is just too attractive, too successful, and too rich-looking to be Peter Parker. So he just comes across as a bit of a tool.
I love him, so I do. But I found it, like, inversely quite difficult to buy Paul Rudd in the scenes where, you know, there's, like, quite a good, like, female gazy moment where she's, like, looking at him shirtless and it's, like, her eyes, his body. And I was just like, nah, sorry, can't buy this.
But I think overall,
a fun trip.
Yeah, film wise, it's kind of like, it's the, you know, you wouldn't kick it out of bed of films.
It's no Iron Man 2.
Yeah.
You would always pick Ant Man over Iron Man 2.
If you like the big cow close up, small cow far away joke from Father Ted, it's probably a movie for you. Basically.
Yes, excellent point.
Last week, I recommended the film Obvious Child to Caroline. So, what did you think of Obvious Child?
I really enjoyed it. I feel like it's a film that belongs very much in a kind of canon with Lena Dunham's Girls and bits of Broad City and stuff like that. It's very much a kind of like Young Women in New York
Absolutely,
thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I really like that. And, of course, the main thrust of the film is this character who is a stand-up comedian who gets pregnant from a one-night stand and decides to have an abortion, and then it's just sort of like everything that happens to her after that. I liked how... I suppose this sounds like it's trivialising it, but it's not. But I liked how light-hearted a take it was.
Absolutely.
On abortion.
Something like Juno, which again is a light-hearted take in a sense, in that it's very funny, it's different to that in that there's no real, like, great emotional wrestling over the decision whether or not to have an abortion, and it doesn't seem to be a very didactic film at all.
It reminded me a lot of, I think there's an episode in the first series of Girls where one of the characters is having an abortion and her friend has made the appointment and her three friends have all come to the clinic to support her, and she doesn't turn up. She just doesn't show up.
Mm.
And the one who's organised it all for her is kind of feeling a bit grumpy about this. And Hannah comforts her by going like, oh, baby, but you threw a lovely abortion.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I felt with this film. It's sort of like her best friend who kind of helps her through all of it at no point sort of puts any stress on her about like, are you really sure about this? Have you thought about this? Just like, I trust you, you know what you're doing, let's try and do this in a way that's unharmful to you as possible.
Yeah, but even in Girls, like the fact that Jessa doesn't turn up is kind of a little bit like, oh, this is a big decision for a woman to make. And I'm sure that is true for a lot of women, I don't want to suggest that it's not, but I think one of the things that is just so nice about it is that, you know, she just goes, she doesn't tell him, does she, about it beforehand? It takes her a long time.
It takes her a long time. There are several sort of moments where she kind of tries to tell him. This guy who, you know, she meets in the bar where she does her stand-up act, and they get some drinks and one thing leads to another and they end up in bed. And then they kind of are, after she's found out she's pregnant and before her clinic appointment, she hangs out with him some more and they really get on and she really likes him and she realizes she wants to tell him. But every time she tries, something sort of mediumly hilarious intervenes. Like, they're in a restaurant and she's kind of on the edge having dinner and she's on the edge of telling him, and there's like an old couple in the corner and he just suddenly comes out with like, oh, I can't wait to be a granddad.
Oh,
she's
God.
Like, I can't tell him now.
Yeah, I wonder, so this is, so essentially it's a rom-com. How successful was it for you as like a, both in terms of rom and com, firstly com?
Mediumly so.
Yeah.
In com terms. I liked the kind of gross out humour aspect of it quite a bit. Like her sort of, the character's act, stand-up act.
Yeah. The sort of meta theatre moment is the fact that there's lots of kind of, as you'd expect for a film about a comedian, there's lots of sort of shots of her stand-up routines, and also like in her conversations people will be like, oh, stop being like the stand-up you sometimes. Yeah. So there's like lots of kind of jokes.
Yeah, and I liked most of that. I found it funny. And I liked how I'm always into when like women feel like they can make jokes about stuff that happens with their bodies. You don't have to take it so seriously.
Yeah. There's a moment where she basically is feeling, well, it's right at the beginning. The film starts with this idea that she's going through a really tough breakup, where her boyfriend and her best friend were cheating on her. And she does this really, what I found quite disturbing, stand-up routine in like the depths of her despair, where she obviously it's meant to be very, very like hard to watch, but she like talks about like in quote marks doing a murder suey all over them, like because she's like so full of rage. And like that phrase has stuck with me today because I found it so like, oh my god, I'm literally witnessing this person's breakdown. So in that sense, it was quite successful, I think, in like, yeah, finding the dark side of comedy without it being too, like, in your face. Dreadful.
I was recently dumped up with. My very nice, close friend, who's such a nice person, decided to sleep with my boyfriend. I would love to just murder-suicide them.
And then in rom terms, I wasn't massively invested in the idea of them as a couple.
I really like the guy. I can't remember the actor's name, but he is Plop from The Office.
He's Plop from The Office, and he looks, I don't even know if he is, but he looks really Canadian.
Yeah, he looks absolutely like he just spends his weekends hiking, doesn't he?
And I think, I feel like because the film is so explicitly from her point of view, we're not really supposed to feel like we know very much about him.
True,
or he exists only as he pertains to her, which is, you know, given the way around the genders, are quite a refreshing thing for that to be the case in this film.
Although she discovers that he has another relation to her life, which that so her mum is teaching him.
Yes.
And so he ends up in her mum's house in a moment of very much like, oh, you're not someone I know in this way, and you're like in my familial space.
Yeah.
So just like with the granddad with kids moments, there are all these kind of little moments that sort of try and force them into a family setting together. And I think it's quite refreshing that instead of caving to that pressure, it still manages to be a happy ending rom-commy film without them having to be like, oh yes, we must like be a family and have children and babies.
And perhaps slightly counterintuitively, another thing I liked about it, which was, even though I think it did get a bit of kind of write-up when it came out as like, oh, the abortion comedy, ooh, daring, trying to do comedy about abortion, particularly in the US, because the whole debate is so much more fraught there. It's not a film that's trying to really make points or answer questions. It is fundamentally a funny film. They were trying to make a funny film first and then say political things second. And sometimes when you're aware that something's got that reputation or been written up like that, it's actually quite a relief to just experience it as entertainment.
Mm.
So I like that feeling about it.
Yeah, it's awful when films sort of eat themselves in their attempts to be controversial. And this film is actually very gentle, I think, in comparison to how it was made out to be.
Yeah, yeah, so definitely a good recommendation. Thank you very much.
Great.
I enjoyed it.
So what have you got for me?
So I thought we'd go into a genre we've not explored much yet on the podcast, which is comic books.
Okay.
I'm not very knowledgeable about comics at all, but I have a good friend who is, and who, whenever he comes across something that he thinks I'll like, he kind of sends it my way. And he did this with a relatively new series called The Wicked and the Divine, which is by a British comics writer, illustrator team, Jamie McKelvey and Kieran Gillen. And it's kind of like YA comics.
Okay, cool.
So it's about a group of young people who, it's a fairly classic story, it's a group of young people who discover that they're kind of superheroes, or rather that they're reincarnations of ancient gods. And this happens like once every 90 years in this group, and it's happened again. And then once they've been reincarnated, they live for 2 years, so like two really sort of bright, burning years, and then they die. And this is about their self-discovery and also the way the world responds to them.
That sounds not like anything I've read before. So.
And I think it's got a really interesting visual style as well. It's very like bright and bold and interesting, and also very modern. I think quite a lot of I'm not very well informed enough to say this, but there's definitely a strand of comics that is kind of nostalgic that sticks with visual styles that have always been the case, particularly for long-running series, but this is absolutely not that. They've departed from that and invented their own language.
Oh, that sounds awesome. I can't wait to read it. So we're actually going on holiday, yay, because it's summer, for a couple of weeks. So this is the last Seriously for 2 weeks, but we'll be back on the 17th of August. So put it in your diary, guys.
Yeah, and in the meantime, send us lots of questions and recommendations and stuff for what we can do when we get back.
See you then. Bye. Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from the New Statesman. I'm Anna.
And I'm Caroline. You can find us on iTunes.
Our Twitter is at SeriouslyPod.
And if you want to send us an email, we're SeriouslyPod, SRSLYPod at gmail.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.